Happy Mother's Day. I was regretting this week that we weren't still in Kings, because there were these great mother stories in Kings. There's, of course, you always have a Jezebel. You know, it's wonderful mother stories you can draw from that. Then in 2 Kings, you have Athaliah. She's the one that killed all of her grandchildren so she could be queen. That's a rather nice mother story. But I guess there is one other in there that actually would work, as opposed to... of course, you could do those two. You could do, talk about their character and then make the conclusion that a good mother is the opposite. And you could always do that. But there is one in here. As Athaliah was killing all of her grandchildren, Jehosheba, she's the one that took Joash and hid him away. For was it 6 years in the Lord's house? So I think that's about the only one that you could come up with in Kings of being a great story and of a not truly a mother, but one that had a mother's heart, if you would, and the sacrifice. But in Daniel, there's almost an absence, of women. You could make possibly some conclusions from Daniel that Daniel's mother would be a woman of great character, because you're always trying to figure out where did Daniel come with his character, how was that developed, and it's just the absence of it. There is Nebuchadnezzar's wife. However, I'm not sure that she was a good mother or that she was a godly woman, though she may, it would seem that she, as we look at the Daniel 4 today, you could be an argument from silence, basically, but you could say, well, surely she was influenced by the things that happened to Nebuchadnezzar. As he went on this spiritual journey, surely she was impacted by that spiritual journey, even though she's never mentioned in that. But after Nebuchadnezzar dies, as we'll see later, when you have the handwriting on the wall, she's the one that comes to her son and says, there is someone in this kingdom. There is one that your father trusted, that maybe you ought to ask him. But apart from any obvious mothers to allude to in this section, I've chosen just to continue in our studies in Daniel. And in Daniel chapter 4, have one of, and I don't know, I guess you could say that with all of the stories in Daniel, intriguing, the highest. I'm not sure which one of those, quote, Bible stories you'd come up with. This isn't the typical Bible story, though. The one with Daniel in the lion's den, as we'll come to, that's, has to be, one of the hallmark Bible stories for kids. Even the one with the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not bowing down, that one's depicted in various stories. This one you don't really hear, and I don't think it would be a, quote, a Bible story as such, but it is one of the more intriguing stories. And partly because of what the story actually says, and then partly because of the way it's told. You see movies from time to time that began with the ending. They'll show something that's happened, And sometimes it is not real significant. Just kind of showing you that this is something. And then it goes back and it says a week later, or, you know, 10 years earlier, or whatever. And it moves there. Sometimes they're very significant. You know, some guy's dying and it says, you know, 36 hours earlier, you know, and it tells you, you know, this is how he came to die. And sometimes those are intriguing because of that reversal and trying to keep up with it. Well, if you were to look at this chapter 4 that way, it would start with, you know, on the screen of the movie, it'd say present day. And, and the caption, you know, the end is a good place to begin. That's what you'd look at in this. The end is a good place to begin. And Nebuchadnezzar, a Gentile king, shares with the world his testimony about the signs and wonders the Most High God has performed in his life. I mean, think about that. A Gentile king. And at this time, he is the king of the most significant nation on the earth. He shares with the world his testimony about signs and wonders that the Most High God has performed in his life. And you have several things there that just do not fit with the stereotypes that we would have of somebody in great power. Number one, in great power, you're not going to make yourself vulnerable by sharing. And here is, you know, a nation like all other nations at this time, they have a variety of gods. You got gods for everything. And he wants to talk about the Most High God. Well, I mean, just think about that term for a while. Most High God. I mean, there are certain ways you define things that you kind of win by your definition. You know, if you're the first one to get to frame the question sometimes, or frame the statement, you know, everybody's struggling because you've already framed it in such a way. So if you say, I serve the Most High God, I mean, unless you want to be like children playing that says, well, I serve the Most High God, I mean, what are you going to say? You know, unless you're just going to keep throwing, you know, see how many can put the most in front of it. You know, by default, he's God. The Most High God. I mean, because, you know, it's, we let that statement or that description just kind of fly by us and we never recognize it. It's just a description of God in the Bible. And, it, you know, it sounds good. But I don't know that it really catches us because we don't deal with lots of gods. You know, we're not like, here's a god here, here's a god here, there's the sun god, there's the moon god, here's the rain god, here's the fertility god, here's the agriculture god, here's the, you know, we don't have that. But if you think about that, all of those, and then here it is, the Most High God. Somewhat like Paul when he was at Athens and he's trying to figure out a way to talk to these people, and they've got a god to everything. They even have a god out there because they're so afraid they might have missed a god. They got this statue to the unknown god. Just in case we haven't covered all the bases, you know, here's the unknown god. And so Paul says, well, you know, that unknown god, I know him. Let me tell you about him. And that's Paul's, you know, evangelical or evangelistic approach is, hey, the unknown god, I know him. Well, here it's the Most High God. And so you have Nebuchadnezzar being vulnerable, sharing, and as you get into the account, he's very vulnerable. But he's talking about the signs and the wonders of the Most High God. Well, it begins in chapter 4 and verse 1. It says, Nebuchadnezzar, the king to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language that live in all the earth. I mean, do you realize we have a letter that is addressed to the world? And this is before, you know, TV, before satellite, being able to broadcast it around the world, before CNN. This is, you know, nevertheless, the world as they knew it, here was the most prominent nation, thus the most prominent man on the earth, and he's saying, I've got something for everybody. May your peace abound. it has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. How great are His signs, and how mighty are His wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and His dominion is from generation to generation. And God is elevated in this statement. The God that he's talking about is superior to all others. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. But even notice that. There's a hint in his terminology. Gods didn't have kingdoms. Gods had certain areas they were, I guess, sovereign over. And so this God, he can make our crops grow. This God can do this. This God can do this. But here is a God that's over king. You know, his territory is viewed as a kingdom. It's everlasting. Well, then the screen would flash 10 years earlier. Now, the 10 years is not textual. There's nothing in the Bible to say it's 10 years. We know it's going to be 7 years plus. We know it's at least seven, and then it had to be some time period, surely, for this all to sink in and for him to come to point of writing. So, is it 7 years in one day? Perhaps. Was it 15 years? Perhaps. I just chose the word 10. The king requests that Daniel interpret his second dream, and that's what we see in verses 4 to 9. The king, as he says in verse 5, I saw a dream and it made me fearful. And these fantasies as I lie on my bed and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. And so that's his, you know, I had a dream. Remember his first dream, he had a dream. It was puzzling. But here, you know, this is a scary dream. He's afraid. I'm not sure about this. And he calls everybody in once again. And, you know, and then he finally quickly discerns but it is finally, as verse 8 says, but finally Daniel came in before me. So Daniel comes in, and notice what he says about Daniel. And of course, this is him writing in the present, looking back in the past. According to the name of my God, that, you know, he has a name, Belshazzar. According to the name of my God, in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And I related the dream to him. Here is Daniel. Daniel is endowed in ways that other people aren't. And I told Daniel about this. And so, here's the setting. You know, I had a dream. The dream scares me. Daniel was called in. Other people weren't able to help, but Daniel was. And then verses 10 to 18, the king tells of the dream, and the dream is, or the focus of the dream is a large tree. And that's basically the dream. I saw this tree, and this tree grew. It's a huge tree. And few of us have ever thought about trees this way. You know, just the value of such a tree. I mean, this tree is huge. The tree is big, and it provides shade. And so it's a resting place. You know, animals, creatures would come to be under the shade tree to rest and to escape the elements. But also, it's a place of safety for those that can climb up in the tree to get away from other. You know, it's a place of safety. It's a place that birds would come and build nests. And so it's a home. But it's also a fruit tree, and so it provides nourishment for all. You know, have you ever? I don't think I've ever thought of a tree that way. That a tree, you know, could provide so much. It provides shade. It provides shelter. It provides homes. It provides nourishment. But that's how this tree is described. And this is a huge tree. This is giant. Giant tree. But the tree is chopped down. The tree is chopped down. And a band of bronze is put around the tree, cases this, and that seems puzzling. And but the story of the tree shifts. it stops talking about the tree as it's going on, and it switches to him. It starts talking about him. In verse 15 it says, "Yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it, and the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beast in the grass of the earth, and let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes and sets over it the lowliest of men." So there's the dream. There's the dream. Well, the interpretation comes next. The interpretation focuses on the terrifying spiritual journey that King Nebuchadnezzar will travel to discover that the God of heaven, rather than a king on earth, truly rules both heaven and earth. You know, we have this something in us. You know, have no doubt that it comes from our depravity, this sense of grandeur about ourselves and our ability to accomplish. And if you look at what man, not me, but what other people have been able to accomplish, it is astounding. I mean, you know, in the developments in our lifetime, or compared to the world, it's overwhelming. But the developments in the last 100 years, I mean, you know, 100 years ago, people were trying to come up with ways that you could actually make a machine fly. And, you know, 60 years later, they fly to the moon. And then flights in outer space became routine. And then you have the Challenger blows up, and I remember that day, just, it's like, how can this happen? We're beyond that. I just remember thinking that all day. We're beyond that. I mean, the arrogance of mankind. You know, we can master the universe. How did this disaster happen? And then when you find that the disaster really comes down to a little bitty, you know, part that cost a dollar. It's like, how can this happen? Well, that's what Nebuchadnezzar is learning. And if we struggle with that, even though we have the Bible and even though we believe that there is one God, what's it like for somebody that believes he's above all gods? So Daniel goes through and tells him. In 19, Daniel says, first he's just shocked. He's appalled, he says, for a while. And he's alarmed. Well, I think, you know, why is he appalled and why is he alarmed? I mean, is it such a frightening dream? I don't think that's why he's alarmed. It's, okay, now I have to tell the king this kind of news. Remember the first time it was like, "Hey, King, God has made you top." Now, that's a pretty easy story to tell the king. And everybody's going to become lesser and lesser after you pass off the scene. But now he's saying to the king, "Hey, your bad days are ahead of you." I mean, days like few of anybody has ever experienced. And Daniel's, I'm sure, trying to think through this now. How do I do this? Verse 20, "The tree that you saw, which became large and grew strong, whose height reached to the sky, was visible to all the earth, and whose foliage was beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in which the food for all, under which the beast of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of the skies lodged. It is you, O king, for you have become great and grown strong, and your majesty has become great and reached to the sky, and your dominion to the end of the earth. I'm sure the king's like, hey, I like that. But if he's thinking ahead, he's going like, what's this thing about being chopped down? And that the king saw an angelic watcher, a holy one, descend from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, yet leave the stump with its root in the ground, but with a band of iron and bronze around it, and the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beast of the field until 7 periods of time pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my Lord the King, that you be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place be with the beast of the field, and that you be given grass to eat like cattle, and be drenched with the dew of heaven. And 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and bestows it on whomever he wishes. And in that it was commanded to leave the stump with the roots of the tree, your kingdom will be assured to you after you recognize that it is heaven that rules. Well, if there's a comforting thing, if you're the king and you were buying into this, it's, there is an end to this, and I get my kingdom back. 7 years, you're going to be crazy, basically. By any description that we would want to use the word that somebody's crazy, that's what's going to come on him. He is going to lose all sense of being a human. He's going to walk around as though he was an animal of the field, unkept, eating grass like a cow, hair not cut, nails not trimmed. Now, I mean, you know, if you want to go to another type of a movie, you would say, okay, here's this homeless guy, and for whatever reason, he's arrested for something. He's suspected of this or that, and they take him in and they fingerprint him and find out this is the lost heir of, you know, the Rockefeller fortune or whatever. I mean, except he's not lost. I don't know what happens after a while. Do they basically just quit watching him? Where's the grass? I mean, did he stay in the palace and it's, you know, in the back fenced in field so we can protect him? 7 years is a long time. So, you know, try to use your mind and imagine how you would, if you were telling this story. I mean, we're not just going to skip the 7 years. We're making a movie of it. We got to depict this 7 years. But what happens? I mean, at first, people are out watching for him and trying to talk to him, trying to protect him. And after a while, you know, you try to cut his nails, trim his hair, but he's always fighting. We have a little Jack Russell Terrier, and she is so sweet, unless you try to cut her nails. It is a battle. And, you know, I take her places, and some people do it pretty well, and some, it's a bad experience for them. And you know, so what do you do with this king? I mean, did he start fighting? I mean, he's an animal. He doesn't understand. He doesn't know why you're trying to cut his nails. He doesn't know why you want to cut his hair. He just wants to be left alone and eat grass. I mean, by our terminology, this guy is absolutely crazy. So at first you say, oh, it's a phase. He'll get over it. After a while, the guard comes, guard goes. Does the story get lost? Oh, yeah, this is 7 years. Remember, Daniel said it'd be 7 years. Well, maybe that's easy to believe on day one, but after a year of this, does anybody really believe he's going to get better? I don't know. I'm just, you know, I really do not know. The Bible doesn't tell us, but you start imagining, what would it be like? I would suspect that after a while, people just, you know, he's written off. Somehow, though, the kingdom stays intact, which we know is divine protection. Because you know that people would take over. You know people would shoot them. You know they'd do whatever to get in control, but it doesn't happen. That's divine protection. But this guy is just wandering around in fields. Was he actually out in, you know, the forest? I don't know. Seems to me that there were probably some protection. But at some point, do you keep protecting the guy? Did the kingdom know? See, I suspect the kingdom didn't know, but yet at one point, you know, when the king never is around, is what are the rumors? I mean, people have to know what rumors went out. I mean, it surely cannot be very assuring to know that your king is, you know, thinks he's a cow. But that's what happens. Or that's what's going to happen. Well, verse 27 says, therefore, this is Daniel, he advises the king to repent. Therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you, break away now from your sins by doing righteousness, and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, in case there may be a prolonging of your prosperity. Maybe there's a chance you can avoid this. Repent. But then on the screen it flashes 1 year later. King is walking around. It's been a year. Nothing's happened. I mean, what did the king do the first week? You know, maybe he went out and said, okay, mow the grass, keep this really, you know, point people to make sure you keep this garden really nice, put up a fence to protect me. I don't know. What would you do? Week, you know, month two, nothing happens. Month three, nothing happens. Month four, he's starting to forget it. Month five, he doesn't even remember that he ever had that conversation with Daniel. Month six, that's big. Month seven, man, he's dreaming of the future. Yeah, month 13, it says 12 months, a year later, verse 29. He's walking around the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. The king reflected and said, is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built? Is this not the place I built? Me, myself, I'm the one in charge. I built it. I built it by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty. This was built by my sovereign ability. This was built for my glory. That's Nebuchadnezzar a year later. Forgot the dream? Yeah, I think so. While the word was in the king's mouth, a voice from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you, and you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beast of the field. See, there it, really the picture isn't a protective fence. Driven away from mankind. His spiritual journey begins. And 28 to 33 just describes that he's, you know, what's going to happen. Just going to be crazy. Just going to be like an animal for 7 years. And it happens immediately. It's not this slow thing. You know, like one day he was a little paranoid. He said, I don't really want to be around people. And, you know, I really don't want to eat meat. Ugh, I don't like meat. Give me some vegetables. I really like the lettuce. Give me a salad. That's where I just had this appetite for salad. You know, it's not gradual. It's boom. He was told. How terrifying is it in that moment? What flashed before his eyes? I mean, you know, talk about a great movie. If you could fill in all those things and you had all that description, which God said, you don't need to know, I'm not telling you. But immediately, he was on this spiritual journey. Unlike any spiritual journey you want to be on. Well, then it was flashed on our screen 7 years later. 7 years later. King Nebuchadnezzar honors the Most High God. Verse 34. But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who lives forever. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but He does according to His will in the Most High heaven and among the inhabitants of earth. And no one can ward off His hand or say to Him, "What have you done?" At that time my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom, and my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out. So I was reestablished in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven, for all His works are true, and His ways just, and He is able to humble those who walk in pride. That's a personal testimony. He is able to humble those that walk in pride. Nebuchadnezzar was above everybody, and yet he was humbled. And he's speaking from a personal testimony. He is able to humble those that walk in pride. What a spiritual journey. Now, the intriguing thing to ask those questions that we don't have answers to is, in our terminology, was Nebuchadnezzar saved? Will Nebuchadnezzar be in heaven? Calvin said no. But what are we going to put on the text? What had to be here for us to think that he was saved? I mean, remember this, it has a different type of revelation than we have. There wasn't Jesus Christ to believe in. There wasn't even a sacrificial system of the Jewish nation at this time to go be, join the Jewish nation as a proselyte, be a part of them and walk with them. That's not even in existence now because Nebuchadnezzar wiped them out. But notice the response. I mean, what else do you want him to say to show that there's been a significant or the significant change in his life? He acknowledges that there is a God, and this God is sovereign. He is sovereign over all. And he is able to even make a person, a proud person, humble. And he's speaking personally of himself. I think Nebuchadnezzar, by our terminology, is saved. He responded to the revelation that he received. But the revelation he received wasn't any typical gospel message. He was literally driven crazy and returned from that. Just as quickly as he was crazy, he returned from it. Now, what does he remember? I mean, if you're crazy, what do you remember? I don't know. He obviously remembered it because he told the story. I don't think the story is to be thought of that, well, he went and asked people, what was it like for me? The story is personal. It's first person. Nebuchadnezzar's spiritual journey really isn't this chapter, though. It's three chapters. Let's reflect upon Nebuchadnezzar's spiritual journey. In chapter 2, well, I guess you could begin if you wanted to in chapter 1. There's not a whole lot that's said there. But we just see him as becoming king. And, I don't know, there's a whole lot of a spiritual journey. I guess you could say that's the starting point. He is sovereign. He is king. He's just been made king. He wipes out Jerusalem. He brings people and makes them a part of his own. He gathers people together for his own purposes. That's Nebuchadnezzar. I'm in charge. Everybody is here to serve me throughout the whole world. Bring the best of everybody here to serve me. Chapter 2, he has a dream. He ends up calling Daniel in to explain the dream and the interpretation of the dream. And it all has to do with revelation in chapter 2. It's revelation. What it's learned here is that God is superior, that God discloses secret. In 247, the king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods, and a Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Notice his view. Your God, Daniel. Your God. He's a God of gods. He's a Lord of kings. He seems to be above other gods. He's kind of a, you know, he seems to be lofty above other gods. And he's a revealer of mysteries, but there's not, it's not the same as where he's going. But he still, he recognizes something about Daniel's God. Hey, your God's pretty, he's pretty cool. He's pretty cool, Daniel. Well, chapter 3, there's recognition. There was revelation in the first, or in chapter 2. Now there's a recognition. He sees God, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as a Savior. He's a Savior. And he delivers his own. He's impressed with a God that can deliver. Because remember, he said, "There is not a God who can deliver you out of my hands." And then they're delivered, and he goes, "Oof, this is a God that can deliver." Chapter 2 and verse, or chapter 3, verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who put their trust in him, violating the king's command, and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn from land to land, and their houses reduced to rubbish. Inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver this way." Now, is he the only God? No. Nebuchadnezzar is not saying he's the only God. First, it's Daniel's God. Your God, Daniel, he's special. He reveals mystery. There's no other God that can do that. He's special. Oh, your God, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, there's no God that can deliver like you. I mean, your God is a deliverer. He is something else. But see, he's still one of the gods, but there's something superior about this God of Daniel and this God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which surely Nebuchadnezzar sees as the same God. He's a revealer of mysteries. He's a deliverer. And then in this chapter, it's a realization. See, I think that's the journey. He's a revealer. There's a recognition that he's a deliverer. Now there's the realization that God, the Most High God, is sovereign. See, it's one thing to be a revealer of mysteries, and you got, you know, the inside track on that, nobody else can do it. You reveal mysteries, but that's what you're good for, is revealing mysteries. Oh, you're a deliverer. Well, that's good. That's pretty great. But you're still the revealer of mysteries. You're the deliverer when people are in trouble. But when you say you're sovereign, you're over everything. He is sovereign. He dominates every realm. Look at his wording again in chapter 4. The chapter begins, "To all the people, nations, and men of every language that live in all the earth." Verse 2. "It has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me." The Most High God. "How great are His signs, and how mighty are His wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and His dominion is from generation to generation." It's not just one of the gods now. We're talking about the God. And then the conclusion of the chapter, again, middle of verse 34. "For His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and His kingdom endures from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are counted as nothing." I mean, when you compare to Him, and there is no comparison. "But He does according to His will in the host of heaven." You know, let's think of this. If you're in a plurality of gods, and there's one God that does according to His will, He's over all those gods. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar is saying, this God, I don't know if he's saying there aren't any other gods at this point. That may be beyond what the text is saying. But he is clearly saying, if there are other gods, this God is above them. He does what he wants. There aren't gods interfering with him. Matter of fact, if these other gods get to do anything, it's only because he lets them. He does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? See, and you're looking at a king that says, nobody can deliver you guys out of my hand. And God does deliver them. He's saying, hey, look at Babylon. I've created for my glory. And he's going, hey, God does something to you, like make you crazy. You can't say, what have you done to me? Because you're the creature. He's God. I mean, this is pretty astounding. And then he concludes, I praise, exalt, and honor the King of Heaven. I mean, you think of the realm. You have gods here, gods here. They're all kind of coming from, up for whatever reason. We always think up. There's a king up there. He's got a kingdom, and he's over everything. I mean, if he's not at this point, saying, hey, I don't believe in other gods, he is clearly saying, this God is tops. He's over everything. And I don't really see any reason to think that he hasn't rejected the whole concept of gods at this point myself. But if that's beyond what the text is actually saying, it's clearly saying, he's seen a God that is the God. For all his works are true and his ways just. You don't speak of gods that way. Gods did certain things. There wasn't about truth or justice. It was just about an exertion of power. They made crops grow. They provided sun. They did this. They did this. Here's a God that is true and just. And he is able to humble. You know, if you're able to humble, I mean, that's a personal involvement. Able to humble those who walk in pride. And he's talking personal. I walked in pride. Spiritual journey. Again, Daniel, this early part of Daniel is about establishing God's right to rule. That if you're going to be a Gentile king in this time of the Gentiles, when Israel is not a nation as such, you better understand they're my people and I'm God. And if you're going to have this reign, then you need to understand you're only here because I appointed you. There is a place that we need to, interact with some of these things. God is sovereign. I don't know how you match all that with bad decisions, wrong decisions, sinful decisions. I truly don't know how you put all that together. God doesn't cause people to do things that are wrong, but God still is sovereign. The fact that people commit sin is not a threat to His sovereignty. When I first became a Christian, I went to a Bible church that, in the issue of salvation, it was more the thought that God looked through the quarters of time and saw what free decision you would make in terms of salvation, and then He confirmed that decision. I don't know that, that's not something I buy into anymore. I'm not a super high Calvinist, but I'm a lot more Calvinistic than that. My point in telling the story is that that's how they saw the salvation, is that basically people made a choice to to trust God. That was pretty high on their list. But I remember talking to a couple, and they were talking about an upcoming election, and the attitude was, why? Why go vote? God appoints kings. What an incredibly high view of sovereignty. Once again, showing the incredible inconsistency that we can have as humans. But when it came to salvation, there was almost a free will of man, but when it came to who was going to be president, God appoints. Now, I don't have any great explanation and way to put all these things together, that God is sovereign and we make choices and we are citizens of a nation that allow us to vote and therefore we ought to exercise that vote. How all that works together, I truly do not know. But I firmly believe that that's the way it is. God is sovereign. We have a responsibility. You know, one of the things we should remember from time to time, though, is God does appoint. It doesn't make everything that goes on right or wrong. And it doesn't excuse things, but, you know, when we look at a world and we look at leaders of certain nations and the way things go and, you know, this and that, how did Hitler get in power? How did people allow this to happen? But yeah, God is sovereign. Did God anoint, if you want to use that word, which we usually reserve for spiritual things, did he anoint Hitler to be dictator of Germany? Yeah, he did. Did that make him right, that is Hitler, you know, that he's therefore able to do what he wants? No, he's responsible. Somewhere in that is, you know, for us to step back, it doesn't excuse people from wrong decisions, but we're to recognize that God is sovereign. Doesn't mean you don't speak out against things that are wrong. Doesn't mean you don't fight against injustices, but you recognize God is sovereign. And that's the real challenge. Because see, it would be so easy in one sense just to be passive and say, God is sovereign. It doesn't really matter what I do. God is sovereign. And become fatalistic. But the Bible doesn't embrace, there's nothing about us being fatalistic. It's about us being responsible. But yet at the same time, God is sovereign. You know, if I was going to summarize the Old Testament in terms of the revelation about God, it would be twofold. One is that God is holy. And the other one, he has the right to rule. I think that is the two primary characteristics, the revelation of God in the Old Testament. He is holy, and he has the right to rule. In Daniel, it's not about his holiness. It's about his right to rule. He has the right to rule. Nebuchadnezzar, as the most powerful person on the earth, came to realize in a very personal way that God has the right to rule. To me, that is responding to the revelation he was given, and so it's hard for me to think that that somehow doesn't equate to salvation, but nevertheless, the point of this chapter and this book isn't about personal salvation. It's about the nation of Israel. And it's about that God has not abandoned them. He is working, if you would, behind the scenes. And he is telling the Gentile king, hey, that nation that you conquered is my nation. You're king, but remember, you're only king because I appointed you king. And I'm their God, and I'm over you. What an incredible God. That he does not abandon. He is sovereign. Will you stand with me as we close in prayer? Father, we do thank you for your revelation. We thank you for this book of Daniel. It's so intriguing sometimes as we come to great Bible stories as we think of them. Because they're fun to tell. Because they're easy to imagine. But also as we look at this one, we see a profound, profound truth. That you're sovereign. You're the sovereign God. Therefore, what is there for us to be proud of other than to be proud that we know you? And would you pray in Christ's name?